You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 347, Jonah and the Chaos Dragon. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how are you?
Pretty good. You know, all things considered, anxious to go get back to the Old Testament today, at least more fully.
Yeah. Well, yeah. This is, you know, I mean, we're covering Jonah here, and actually, you've got one more week of voting in our poll for the next book study that we're going to be doing, and it ends next week. Next Saturday, Halloween at midnight. So if you have not done so, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and cast your vote. Right now, though, Mike, I think the Old Testament and Revelation is holding at 68-67%.
Well, you know, it would have been nice if we could have, you know, if we would have put the vote up a little earlier, because then we could start the apocalypse maybe right after the apocalypse of the election. You know, we could have done something there. We just weren't thinking ahead.
Now, only if you're thinking in those terms, which I don't. So, yeah, that's all you. It's not me. Yeah, I hear you, Mike. I hear you on that one. But, you know, by covering Jonah here, you know, we had it planned to do this topic a while now. So hopefully for those who voted for Jonah, hopefully this episode will whet their appetite or hold them over until the next vote.
Well, that's a nice thought. Hopefully it will do that for somebody, because it's, Jonah's not looking too good as far as the voting goes.
No. But next time, since Jonah and Jude are so short, hopefully we'll include another short one on the vote. We can cover more books rather than these big, long, epic, year-long treks through these 40-chapter books.
Right. But, it is what it is.
Hey, that's all right. You know, Revelation's not too long. I mean, what is it, 22 chapters?
Yeah, 22 chapters. You know, but I'm sure it's not going to be a chapter a week. I think we are looking at a year, if that's, you know, where it all ends up. But, you know, in my experience, people have a very high tolerance for spending time in the book of Revelation. So I'm not real worried about it.
I mean, Mike, I'm not going to lie. You know, even in my younger years, it was all about Revelation. I mean, that's just the most interesting topic in times, right? That's just kind of what grabs you. It's just interesting because it's so weird.
Yeah. Well, I can say I was a teenage prophecy nerd. You know, that was one of the first things I read after becoming a Christian. It was like some well-meaning person handed me prophecy books. There I was gone.
Yeah. So, but what's interesting is you get into it, that kind of melts away as far as my interest is concerned. So I don't know if it's maturing or growing up or what it is, but.
Are you saying that no one matures into prophecy nerddom?
Yes.
You just mature out of it?
Correct. That's exactly what I'm saying.
Okay.
What's your thoughts on that? Do you agree? Disagree?
No, I agree. I agree. I mean, that's what happened to me. You know, I just remember as a teenager, I thought Gorbachev had the wounded head and was the Antichrist, you know, and turned out that wasn't the case. You know, what can I say?
I hear you. Well, I'm interested where we're going here. Obviously, when you talk about chaos, there's so many implications of that. And, you know, we've touched on it here and there. And so I'm going to be listening to this one intensely.
Yeah, I mean, I am glad to, you know, move into this a little bit. It's a good, I mean, I enjoy use of the Old Testament by the New Testament writers, but you know, I've been looking at this for a while, and you know, it compared to our forays into the New Testament, this feels like a fresh episode, you know, just kind of Old Testament exclusively. But if we're honest, it's not like 100% exclusive Old Testament, because you know, the Gospels use the sign of Jonah in relationship to, you know, the resurrection of Jesus. So at the end, you know, we'll say something about that. But for the most part, yeah, we're going to stick with the Old Testament book. Obviously, the story's familiar, but for listeners to this podcast anyway, equally as obvious ought to be the thought that there's more to it than meets the eye. And so our focus today is going to be specifically the, in Hebrew, the Dag Gadol, the great fish, and chaos themes. Again, in particular, connections to Leviathan imagery. And for the purposes of this episode, the focus is not going to be the historicity of the story's circumstances, you know, the whole great fish thing. Did that really happen? Is this a historical narrative? Is it a parable? So on and so forth. You know, frankly, you'd have chaos, Leviathan imagery either way, because the text is the text, okay? You know, for me, whether Jonah is a parable or an allegory or historical narrative, it doesn't matter with respect to that, you know, to the imagery. It also doesn't really matter with respect to the New Testament's use of the material. In other words, Jesus' reference to being in the earth over the course of 3 days on analogy to Jonah and the great fish is on target either way, because that's what's in the book of Jonah. That's what's in the text, you know. You know, not specifically, you know, the three-day element, that's going to come from somewhere else, but it's still this analogy of the emergence from the realm of the dead is really the point. So regardless of how you would read Jonah or how anybody else reads Jonah, the New Testament appeal, Jesus' appeal, you know, to this as an analogy, it still holds. And frankly, if the Dag Gadol, the great fish, is connected to chaos imagery, which I'm going to suggest that it is, it makes the analogy all the more appropriate, you know, when it comes to the reference to the resurrection. So again, I know people get a little fixated on this question, you know, history or parable, and I'm just being, you know, transparently honest with you. To me, it doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter what it is if you're asking the question because of the fact that, you know, Jesus uses it. It doesn't matter. If you're asking the question because of some, you know, broader issue of Old Testament historicity or something like that, that a different trajectory might make the question more important, is what I'm trying to say. But for our purposes today, we're not concerned with it. Now, as in other episodes, you know, when we're getting into the Old Testament use in the New, I typically have as a touch point a reference, and this is going to be no different. So the resource of reference today that I find is a really good resource to, you know, tap into, but I'll admit this one is more technical than most. You know, to get the most out of it, you should probably have some Hebrew. But even if you don't, again, we're going to distill certain important points. And then when you read the transcript, the Hebrew will be in transliteration anyway, so you can still get a good deal out of it. But if you wanted the source article, it is this one. It's by Scott Nogel. It's Noegel. And the article is entitled Jonah and Leviathan, subtitle, Inner Biblical Allusions and the Problem with Dragons. It's from the scholarly journal called Henoch, that's Henoch, volume 37, number 2, it's 2015 article. This is available online at Academia, it's, you know, academia.edu. So if you Googled it, you Googled the title with his name, you're going to find it, and that's where the link's going to take you to that website. I'm going to read a little bit from the abstract and then from one of the pages. It'll sort of set up what the issues are that we're going to track through today. So Noel writes in his abstract, early Christian depictions of Jonah's fish, and fish is in quotation marks, as a sea dragon have long posed a problem for scholars. Some have explained it by pointing to the Septuagint's rendering of Jonah's fish as a Katos. In transliteration, that's K long E T O S, Katos, which loosely would refer to a sea creature. Yet this translation is itself problematic, Nogel says, since it is completely out of step with treatments of the term dag, Hebrew term for fish, or translated fish, dag, found elsewhere in the Bible. Others have opined the influence of Jewish Midrashic traditions in which Leviathan plays a role in the Jonah story. You say, well, that's the reason, okay, that you have this connection with Katos and Dog. However, Nogle says said traditions cannot be dated before the 9th century CE or AD, more than half a millennia after the artistic evidence. So let me just stop there. His point of departure here in his abstract is that if you look at early Christian art that relates to Jonah and the quote-unquote fish, many of them depict the fish as a dragon or some kind of sea serpent. And he's like, where does that come from? Does it come from the Septuagint's rendering of the Hebrew word dog, fish, dog gadol, the great fish, with katos, which, again, isn't a word you would use just for a normal generic fish, but you would use it for some kind of, you know, sea creature, some more grotesque, creaturely, sea monster-ish thing. Is the Christian art inspired by the Septuagint's rendering? Or is there something else? Like, is there something he's ultimately gonna ask here toward the end of his abstract? I'm not going to read any more from that because I'm going to skip to a specific page. But he's ultimately going to ask, is this notion, you know, where early Christian or early Christian artistic depictions, okay, you got the Septuagint. Maybe they were inspired by that. Maybe they were led to think about the dog gadol, the great fish, in this way because of the Septuagint. But maybe, he asks, maybe there are other reasons textually that explain why the Septuagint would be, you know, that translator, why he would be thinking of the dog gadol, the great fish, as something monstrous. And more specifically, could that something monstrous be linked to chaos dragon, i.e. Leviathan, literary motifs? Okay, that's what he's basically going to ask. So on page 237, another way of sort of getting into this, where he talks about the issue, he writes this: in Christianity, Jonah was a favorite figure for allegory, taking their lead from Jesus' statement that Jonah was a semeion, which is the Greek word for sign, in Matthew 12, 39 to 40. Early theologians depicted him as prefiguring the Christ, descending into the fish like Jesus into hell, okay? More accurately, Hades or the underworld, and delivered from it, you know, that Jonah, this prefigurement of Christ to early Christians, he was delivered from the fish, from what corresponded to Hades and hell. He was delivered it from it in terms of God saving him for his mission. And with Jesus, of course, Jesus is delivered from hell or Hades, the underworld, for the salvation of the world, the salvation of Gentiles, is how Nogle puts it. And Nogle, when he makes that sentence, he writes that sentence, he has references to a lot of really important early Christian thinkers. You know, Clement, Irenaeus, Ignatius, Justin Martyr, Tertullian, Athanasius, Jerome. I mean, it's a who's who list of early Christians that saw Jonah, again, this way, as some sort of prefigurement of Jesus, and equated where Jonah goes into the fish with going into the underworld. And so, again, this is going to raise a question for Nogle. Why, you know, what appealed to, you know, this equation? Of course, it's in the Gospels, but not only do you get this equation written about by these early church authorities, but when you look at the artwork, the fish is, again, a dragon, a sea monster. You know, is that somehow connected to, you know, the serpent of Genesis 3, or is it, again, the Leviathan, or, you know, just a broader chaos thing? Like, what's going on here? So this is, again, why he wants to, you know, think about this. And he continues, he says, early Greek patristic works identify Jesus as the worm on the fish hook of Job 40, verse 25. Okay, let me just read that verse to you, because that's an odd reference and an odd way we would think of looking at something. But again, early Christian writers, you know, were pretty abstract in their thinking, where, again, essentially to, let me just put it this way. I mean, he has a reference to Job here, but it's, again, just it's the Leviathan, you know, the hook, you know, imagery here. Let me just explain what he's getting at here with the early church folks. Jesus' resurrection led to the defeat of Satan. And so they're looking at Satan, the devil, as the dragon. Okay, and you get that in Revelation 12, verse 9. You get it in Revelation 20, verse 2. You get the devil and Satan and the dragon, you know, of Genesis 3, all tied together. And so Jesus is sort of the bait. He's the hook, you know, to the fish, okay, the dragon getting snared and caught and you know, of course, killed by God. All right, this is how they're looking at it. So he says, when you look at already in the third century CE, again, AD, one finds paintings, sarcophagi, other funerary art that link Jonah to Leviathan by depicting the fish as a fantastic sea monster with large, sharp teeth, tall ears, mammalian forearms, and a long serpentine tail. And in his article, he has pictures of this. So he's like, where did they, you know, it's one thing to say, okay, Jonah gets swallowed by the fish. We know the story. And okay, it's pretty transparent. He gets swallowed, he gets spit up, he goes and he witnesses to the Gentiles, you know, to the to the Assyrians, the Ninevites, okay? But how do you go from that to being in your thinking secure, you know, these early church, you know, writers and artists, of thinking any, you know, about that fish in Jonah in a certain way that equates him with the serpent of Genesis 3, or again, Leviathan, you know, evil forces, you know, because after all, God's the one who commanded the fish, you know, to go swallow Jonah. So why, where do you get these sinister associations? You know, and of course, they, you could look at the Gospels and, you know, Jesus says that what happened to Jonah was a sign. Of course, he's pointing at the resurrection, but Jesus doesn't elaborate. He doesn't say now, you know, here's a sign, you know, yeah, I'm going to get out of, you know, the grave in three days, or again, I'm going to be dead. Then I'm going to be alive, just like Jonah was dead then alive, and, you know, so on and so forth. But Jesus never elaborates on anything else. He doesn't say now when, you know, I'm also telling you this because of this, you know, Genesis 3 or Leviathan or this or that. Jesus doesn't offer any elaboration that would sort of account for why early Christian writers thought this way and depicted the story in their art the way they do. So again, this is how Nogle starts. And he says, you know, there's got to be some way to trace these ideas, you know, to connect these ideas. But when you start looking at the text, you have on the surface, it looks like there's some contradictory things going on here. So here are the issues. I just made a little grocery list of these that you can elicit from the early pages of his article. The first question, again, is what is the Dag Gadol, the great fish? You know, in other words, what is it supposed to be or signify? Second, why does the Septuagint translate Dag as ketos, a word that isn't used elsewhere to translate dog? Let me you know, put that into better English. You have the Hebrew word dog, which is a fish. Again, it's just a generic word for fish. It doesn't tell you what kind of fish, it's just a fish. The Septuagint does not render dog with ketos anywhere else but Jonah. Why? You know, it'll use something else, ichthus or, you know, whatever. You know, why? What is it about Jonah that makes them use a word that, here's item number three, they do use ketos for Leviathan. So the Septuagint uses ketos for Leviathan, and in this one place, it also uses it in Jonah for dog. And the kicker is, if you read through the book of Jonah in Hebrew, the word for Leviathan doesn't appear in Jonah. So why? What is there in the book, in this episode, that makes them think, oh, ketos is the way to render dog here? Yes, I know that everywhere else in the Septuagint, we use a generic word for fish. But here, even though the word Leviathan doesn't show up in the book, here, though, we're looking at a sea monster. You know, again, something like, you know, Leviathan. We're thinking Leviathan for some way, so we're going to use ketos right here. Why do they do that? You know, another thought. Okay, so the Septuagint, if you're paying close attention, the Septuagint uses two terms for Leviathan, though. One is ketos, and the other one it uses is drakon, you know, dragon. So we have a clear association. There's a clear path, a clear link between ketos and drakon and Leviathan. But there doesn't seem to be any reason why a translator would be looking at the Hebrew text of Jonah, and he never sees Leviathan in Hebrew. That's the word for Leviathan. He never sees that. He just sees Dag. Dag Gadol, big fish, okay? Why does he opt for one of the terms that they would use everywhere else for Leviathan. Why? Why does he do that? The Septuagint further uses katos and drakon for another Hebrew term, tanin, the sea monsters or the sea dragons, like in Genesis 1:21, and other verses. I mean, that's not the only place where you have tanin, which is, again, the plural, you know, for dragons. Specifically, we have ta kete ta megala for tanin gedolim, in other words, great dragons or great sea monsters, Genesis 1:21. You know, Septuagint translators will use, you know, katos there. I mean, what, why, when they hit Jonah and they just see this simple, innocent, harmless little dog, little fish, you know, I'm thinking of a sunny or something here. Why would they look at that word and think, you know, katos, you know, sea monster? It just doesn't seem to make any sense. So, you know, those are the issues. You know, it Nogal is wondering, you know, what's going through their heads? What else do they see in the book, in the scene, you know, with the fish, that justified in their minds translating it with a term that they knew their readers would mentally link to Leviathan? Why are they doing that? You know, would mentally link to a chaos symbol. Why are they doing that? So, you know, again, this unraveling this, you know, really is our task for today. That's our point of inquiry. And we're going to follow, you know, Nogal's journey here. I'm going to pick a few things out. This is a technical article. It's fairly dense. I'm going to skip a good number of things in it just to give you sort of the guts of it. Because I think it's really interesting, again, to try to track why the translator's thinking the way that he's thinking when it comes to this word choice. So Nogal writes, though Jonah refers to the creature as a dog four times, and he gives the references, again, this is in the Hebrew text, the ancients were acutely aware of the term's ambiguity. He adds in a footnote, the ambiguity is also reflected in some early Christian art depicting the creature as a fish, whereas in others, it's a sea monster. So even the artwork's not consistent. I mean, some looked at katos and got the message, and then other artists just have a fish, you know. But what he really wants to know is, what's going on with the sea monster thing? Nogal then quotes Jack Sasson's observation in regard to the word dog. He says, it is a fact, moreover, that scripture has preserved no specific names for the many types of salt and freshwater fish known to the Eastern Mediterranean. This does not mean, of course, that the ancient Hebrews were not able to distinguish among the sea the area's wide varieties of fish. It simply suggests that no biblical context seems to require a specific vocabulary for fish. They just didn't bother. There's no need, you know, for them to have a full orbed vocabulary for fish. Nogal nevertheless says, I contend, he writes, that the text of Jonah contains a number of linguistic and thematic features that allude to what he calls tanin traditions, dragon traditions, or Leviathan chaos traditions, as found in several other biblical texts, and that these allusions encouraged the early identification of the dog as a sea monster. So let's just follow his lines of evidence. I'll just give you some samples here. First thing he does is talk about the setting. Okay, Jonah is on a ship in a raging sea. That's Jonah 1:4. Okay, and the Hebrew wording here is kind of interesting. I'm going to read you what ESV has here. So Jonah 1:4. The Lord hurled a great wind upon the sea, and there was a mighty tempest on the sea, so that the ship threatened to break up. Pretty simple. Well, if you're reading it in Hebrew, the tempest is in the sea, not on it, which is kind of interesting. Okay. I mean, you can take the Hebrew there as essentially you're looking down at the waters and there's something churning in there. Now, Leviathan, of course, was associated with the churning sea, especially its danger. You know, there's a number of references here we could go to, but Psalm 104:26. Let's take a look at that one. There go the ships and Leviathan, which you formed to play in it. Okay, in the sea. The earlier verse, the prior verse is, here is the sea great and wide, which teems with creatures innumerable, living things both small and great. And there go the ships and Leviathan, which you formed to play in it. Another reference. Verse 5, the dead, the Rephaim, tremble under the waters and their inhabitants. Sheol is naked before God. Abaddon has no covering, you know, the pit there. And again, there's more cosmological stuff. And you go down to verse 12. By his, God's power, you know, he stilled the sea. By his understanding, he shattered Rahab, which is, again, is another word for the chaos monster. You see it in Psalm 89 as well. By his wind, the heavens were made. By his, and his hand pierced the fleeing serpent. Okay. Or you could also translate that something like the coiled serpent, depending on what root you think is going on there. But anyway, fleeing is just fine, you know, for here. And we've got Leviathan, this sea beast, Rahab, in the sea. And that's obvious. So what Nogal is saying, look, it's kind of interesting that the tempest language in 1:4 could actually be in the sea, as though something's churning around in there, something frightening and dangerous, as opposed to just on top of the water. That's his first point. Second point is the sailor's fearful response to the sea. So this is Jonah 1:13, where we read, the men rowed hard to get back to dry land. And on this point, Nogal writes this. He says, of particular interest here is the verb used for row. It's katar. It is an uncommon word appearing only 8 times in the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, that is. With one exception, it always refers to digging through walls. Okay, so the only other exception other than the Jonah one is Amos 9:2. Amos 9:2, let's just go there. This one's interesting because the digging, you know, the verb here. In Jonah, it's rowing because they're on the water. Okay, here katar is used this way. If they katar into Sheol. They row into Sheol. If they dig into Sheol, from there shall my hand take them. If they climb up to heaven, and there I will bring them down. So the only outlier is Amos 9:2, and it has Sheol as a context. So he says, you know, everything else is like digging and, you know, digging through walls specifically, you know, walls or floors of a house or something like that. And the only two that aren't are Amos 9, which refers to Sheol, and the one in Jonah 1:13. Then he says, thus, its use in Jonah for rowing in water is unique. It's the only time you get it in a water context. Moreover, since Jonah refers to the sea that covers him as Beten Sheol, the womb of Sheol. Jonah actually refers to the water that he winds up in as the womb of Sheol in Jonah 2:3. Since that's the case, the sailor's rowing invites us to recall its usage in Amos. In a prophecy also shaped by Tannaim traditions. Amos's prophecy, there in Amos 9, begins by Yahweh threatening to cut open the enemy and strike him upon the head with a sword, while allowing none to flee. Amos describes the enemy's frantic attempt to dig into Sheol as an impossible attempt to escape. They cannot escape Yahweh. Quote, and though they be hid from my sight on the floor of the sea, then I will command the serpent, in this case it's Hanakash, and he will bite them. Amos 9:3. So in Amos 9:2 and in Amos 9:3, you have a reference to Sheol and a serpent. And Nogal writes that Leviathan is intended here is shown not just by the context, but by the Septuagint's rendering of Nakash with Drakon. So again, to summarize this, what he's saying is, you know, if we look at this verb, we're going to notice that 8 times in the Bible, 6 of those are about digging in a wall or a house. The other 2 are Amos 9 and Jonah 1. And the Amos 9 one is in a passage that is about Sheol, and it has a dragon in it. And then we go to Jonah chapter 1, where now the action of the verb is about rowing through waters that are churning. And Nogal's argument is that it sort of suggests something. It suggests that there's something in the water that is going to be associated to the mind of the reader. And he's going to demonstrate this later on, because Jonah brings up Sheol. It's like Jonah's directing people's attention back to Amos 9. Hey, remember Sheol back there? We were trying to get into Sheol and we couldn't. And then God sent the serpent, you know, to bite them. They're not going to escape punishment. They're not going to escape judgment. Well, guess what? I'm not going to escape judgment either. And I'm about ready to be swallowed up by something. And again, he wants, Nogal's argument is that the writer of Jonah wants readers to fill in the blank, you know, with Leviathan, with the chaos dragon, because The serpent, the dragon, are associated together in Amos, where this unusual verb is found. And so by using the unusual verb in Jonah 1, he wants readers to connect those two dots as well. So that's his second argument. Third argument is Jonah's prayer. Jonah 2:3, and the description of his predicament. This is actually going to go beyond verse 3. It's several verses. There are things in several verses here that are important. Again, reading from the ESV, Jonah prays this in verse 3. For you cast me into the deep. The Hebrew term there is metzulah, into the heart of the seas, and the flood surrounded me. All your waves and your billows passed over me. Now, metzulah shows up, again, in English numbering, in Job 41:31. Job 41:31, where it says, speaking of Leviathan, this section of Job 41 goes all the way back to verse 12 and really the whole chapter. Chapter 41 begins this way. Can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook or press down his tongue with a cord? And there's this long description of Leviathan. And in verse 31, it says this. He, Leviathan, makes the deep, the metzulah, boil like a pot. He makes the sea like a pot of ointment, you know, thick. So, again, what Nogal is saying is, if you look at Jonah's prayer, he uses a term here that, lo and behold, occurs in a Leviathan passage in Job. Actually, kind of a famous one because it's so long. It's basically, the whole chapter, chapter 41, is about Leviathan. Nogal writes, the term appears only 12 other times in the Bible, mostly in ways that evoke Leviathan traditions. Again, he mentions Job 41 again, verse 31, Psalm 107:24. Maybe 106:24. I don't know if there's a typo there. Or in reference to the crossing through the Reed Sea, which is itself a literary refraction of the chaos struggle motif. In Psalm 68, verse 22, we once again have both traditions. We have the sea, and then again this notion of the place where Leviathan makes the sea to churn. Again, and what Nogal wants you to do is he wants you to connect these things. Let me just read you the Psalm 68 reference, because we get Bashan in there, which in Canaanite, remember, Leviathan is a Canaanite symbol. In Canaanite, Bashan is Bathan, which means serpent. Okay, we've said this before in connection with stuff in Unseen Realm, but here are the verses. The Lord said, I will bring them back from Bashan. I will bring them back from the depths of the sea, the Metzulah of the sea. Well, Bashan doesn't have a sea. So it's very clear here in Psalm 68 that he's talking about cosmic geography. He's talking about the place of the serpent. Again, we discussed this in Unseen Realm. This should be familiar. For those of you who are taking the class, the Unseen Realm class that I teach here in Jacksonville, I'm going to reference Charlesworth's article here, because Charlesworth deals with this verse and draws the same conclusion, that we have Bathan here. We have serpent imagery in one line of Psalm 68:22, and then in the next line, we have the Metzulah of the sea, the churning sea. And what Nogal wants is he wants you to listen to this vocabulary and its explanation, and then go back to the stuff we've already covered about how, you know, the story's set on a raging sea, and it's not something on top of the sea, it's something in the sea that's causing it to churn, all right? He wants you to start thinking about, okay, there's something in there. And that something, again, is probably going to end up being this dragon, serpent, Leviathan thing, because Jonah, the writer of Jonah, is starting to draw terminology from other passages that take readers into places like Job 41 and Psalm 68, you know, and Psalm 104 that have Leviathan imagery in them. So Nogal's arguing that the writer is doing this intentionally and intelligently, trying to get his readers to remember other passages that have Leviathan, you know, in it. And not only that, but combine Leviathan with the deep, and further identify the deep as Sheol. Okay, and Jonah, again, himself does this in the passage. Remember, we just read, you know, the one reference where Jonah refers to the sea that covers him in Jonah 2:3 as the womb of Sheol. Right there it is. So if we keep reading in Jonah's prayer. That was, you know, Jonah 2, verse 3. Again, there's something else in verse 3 where Jonah says, all your waves and your billows passed over me. That's ESV. Literally, it's all your waves and nahar passed over me, okay, or surrounded me, maybe is better, you know, in terms of the verb there. But you, instead of waves and billows, you actually have the word nahar. And that, to anyone who's followed this podcast or read Unseen Realm, you should know that that's significant. Nogle writes, the term nahar most often refers generally to a river, a stream, or a canal, or to a specific river like the Nile or the Euphrates, Genesis 15:18, for example. However, when used synonymously with the deep, such as Isaiah 44:27, Ezekiel 31:4, 31:15, 32:2, when used synonymously with the deep and the sea, deep is Tahom, sea is Yam, like in Isaiah 50, Nahum 1:4, Habakkuk 3:8, so on and so forth. When those combinations happen, it refers to the cosmological waters that Yahweh rebukes and or cleaves. Even when used figuratively, nahar does not mean flood, but rather stream, as in Job 20:17. Thus, its appearance immediately after the word yamim sees, you know, nahar and yamim, emits cosmological reverberations and recalls the age-old identification of the river with Leviathan, as attested in Ugaritic texts in the creature's other name. In the Ugaritic texts, Leviathan has another name, and his name is Nahar. Okay. And again, in Unseen Realm, we talk about this, and we've had other podcasts where we talk about chaos imagery. In the Baal cycle, Baal becomes king of the gods when he defeats Nahar. Again, Nahar is you know his deity, cosmic rival. And again, Nahar is also referred to as Leviathan. So Baal is the one who overcomes chaos and becomes king of the gods and is in control of everything and is such a wonderful dude and blah, 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 blah. This is Canaanite religion. It's Canaanite theology 101. Well, here in Jonah, Nahar surrounded me. Nahar overcame me. And he's just referred to the waters that he goes into as the womb of Sheol, the realm of the dead. Baal, again, in Canaanite literature, who defeats Nahar and becomes king of the gods, Baal is lord of the dead. He is lord of Sheol. So Nogle is saying, look, we're starting to stack these Sheol, Nahar, serpent, sea serpent kind of things. We're seeing them just sort of light up as we work our way through Jonah, Jonah 2, Jonah's prayer. They're just nuggets that are kind of embedded in the text that Nogle would say the writer's hoping you start to collect them and start to notice them. You build a collection of these things, and they're all going to essentially point to the same idea. Continuing, from Jonah, 2:3, we have the nahar. Let's look at the verb. The nahar surrounds Jonah. The verb there is savav. It means to encircle, as in the course of a river that twists its way through a territory. The word is used in Genesis 2 of the Pishon and the Gihon, how the river winds its way through a piece of earth. Of course, Leviathan is a twisting, undulating serpent. And serpents encircle their prey, do they not? Isaiah 27:1 gives us, this sort of imagery. In that day, the Lord with his hard and great and strong sword will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent, Leviathan, the twisting serpent or the coiling serpent, the undulating serpent. Okay. This idea. And he will slay the dragon that is in the sea. That's Isaiah 27:1. So Nogle's saying even the verb here suggests how a snake or a serpent will wind its way around its prey and devour it. The term also occurs in Jonah 2:6, where the deep, Tahom, encircles Jonah, again, to devour him. Let's go back to verse 5, 2:5. The waters closed in over me to take my life. The deep surrounded me. Weeds were wrapped around my head. To take my life is in Hebrew, ad nefesh. It says, the waters closed in over me, up to my nephesh. So nephesh on occasion, you can look this up in any lexicon, nephesh doesn't just mean soul or life. In some cases, it means throat, you know, or even breath, really. Nogle writes, as is well known, Tahom is another name for, you know, Tanin, again, the dragon, the deep. Isaiah 51, 9 and 10, again, uses this terminology. It's comparable to Job 41, 24. There we are in Job 41 again. And he says, it is the Hebrew refraction of Tiamat, again, the chaos dragon from Mesopotamia. And there are some scholars who would dispute, you know, that etymological connection, but, you know, we'll just go with it for Nogle's case here. In addition, the expression ad nefesh is polysemous. It's scholars speak for it. It means lots of different things. It can mean even to my throat or even to the breath, like I'm getting the breath choked out of me. Nogle continues again after this idea of, you know, ad nefesh being even up to the throat, even up to my breath, you know, that he's getting the breath, the air, you know, choked out of him. He says, see, for example, the description of Leviathan in Job 41, verse 21. And ESV has, again, this is a description of Leviathan. That's what Job 41 is, the whole thing. His breath kindles coals. Literally, it's his nephesh kindles coals. It doesn't make any sense, his soul. No, that's because nephesh can mean breath or throat. You know, the imagery in Job 41 is like a fire-breathing dragon, okay? So, you know, Nogle refers to that saying, look, you know, here we have a case where the waters close in over me up to my throat. The deep surrounds me. Again, he's getting wrapped around in this serpentine language. You know, weeds were wrapped around my head. And he, you know, again, his argument is this, it's like he's getting killed and devoured by a serpent. That's essentially what Nogle, you know, wants us to see. Verse 6, at the roots of the mountains, I went down to the land. Wait a minute, he's in the sea. What's he talking about, the foot of mountains or underneath mountains, the roots of the mountains? I went down to the land. There's no land like in the sea except for the bottom, okay? Is that what he's talking about? Well, yeah, it's ancient Near Eastern cosmology. Where is Sheol? It's under the earth, inside the earth. I went down to the land whose bars, now we have bars, it's like a prison. I went down to the land whose bars closed upon me forever. He's in Sheol. He's in the realm of the dead. Yet you brought up my life from the pit, O Lord my God. And that's Jonah's prayer. It's loaded, and this is nothing new, you know, for most commentaries that engage the text anyway. They're going to point out the Sheol imagery here in Jonah's prayer all day long. And what Nogle wants us to see is, you know, there's also like Leviathan serpent, you know, imagery here too, because that's married to the underworld stuff as well. And again, you can see already what Nogle's angling for here. He's saying, look, the person who wrote Jonah, an illiterate reader, would follow these you know, breadcrumb trails. They would pick up these nuggets and realize that they all evoke the same imagery, the underworld and the chaos dragon. Okay, this is what he's angling for. He also makes a comment about ad nefesh. That phrase can also mean like a hunger, referring to the appetite of the deep. The deep devours things, devours people. He says support for this reading comes from Jonah's previous description of the deep as the womb or the stomach, beten in Hebrew, you could actually translate either way, of Sheol. Again, Sheol has an appetite. It devours the living. They become the dead. You know, and he references passages like Isaiah 5:14 and Habakkuk 2:5 that describe Sheol as having an insatiable appetite. It really, Sheol is personified like this beast, this creature that is never satisfied. So in this regard, you know, Nogle is going to move on to draw attention to other dragon, Tanin, Leviathan traditions that involve swallowing victims. He has a whole section here. We're going to skip a lot of what he has here. But he references in this discussion, there's one passage I thought would be fun just to bring up here, even though I think it's pretty peripheral. When he's talking about how the Leviathan and the serpent imagery and Sheol imagery about being a swallower or a devourer, he references this verse, Jeremiah 51:44. And this is gonna lead us sort of on a fun sidebar here. The verse says you know, God is pronouncing judgment on Babylon. Let me go back up to verse 42. The sea has come up on Babylon. In other words, now the thing, you know, the chaos is reversed. Babylon's going to get hers. The sea has come up on Babylon. She is covered with its tumultuous waves. Her cities have become a horror, a land of drought and a desert, a land in which no one dwells, just like the underworld, you know, because everybody's dead, and through which no son of man passes. Here's verse 44. And I will punish Bel in Babylon and take out of his mouth what he has swallowed. The nation shall no longer flow to him. The wall of Babylon has fallen. He's going to, you know, the Lord promises he's going to extract the dead from the realm of the dead there. I mean, that's actually what that verse is saying. But what I want to focus on is this reference to Bel in Babylon. Now, Bel is a term that just means Lord or master. It comes from Akkadian, Belu, which means Lord or master. Okay. So this is a title for a deity. And I'm going to quote from ABD, Anchor Bible Dictionary here. It says, the honorific title Belu is of ancient vintage and was used as an exalted appellation in regard to a number of Akkadian deities. However, it concentrated upon the Sumerian god Anlil until this patron deity of Nippur, who was recognized by the Akkadians as the king of the pantheon, became de facto the Belu, the Lord, eclipsing even the theoretical ultimacy of Father Anu. Anlil assumed the role as the Lord of heaven and earth, the determiner of the destinies of the land, so that all the other gods paled before him. The foregoing situation continued, you know, Anlil was the one at the top, until the beginning of the second millennium BC, when Marduk, the patron deity of Babylon, succeeded Anlil as the supreme deity of the pantheon. Two important texts will substantiate this rise to power. The first is Enuma Elish, a composition dated the second millennium BC, wherein the investment of Marduk as the lord of the pantheon is graphically portrayed. When Tiamat threatened the assembly of the gods with chaos and bestowed upon her deputy Kingu the control of the tablets of destiny, Marduk alone of all the gods challenged and utterly defeated the frightful opposition. You know, Marduk slays the chaos dragon Tiamat. For this, he was unanimously acclaimed king of the gods by the appreciative assembly of the deities, and duly invested in that regal office. Then he goes on and on, the writer goes on and on about Marduk and so on and so forth. And then he adds this. The apocryphal story of Bel, verses 3 through 22, and the story of the snake, or the dragon, in verses 23 and 24, in a book called Bel and the Dragon, in the Apocrypha. Okay, this apocryphal story that's in the additions to the Hebrew book of Daniel, you know, have something to say here. The story of Bel relates the disclosure of the deceitful servants of Bel who represented the god Bel as the one who consumed the rich quantity of food set daily before him. The seer Daniel exposed this fraud to the shame of Bel, but to the glory of the god of Daniel. The story of the dragon is another fictional tale designed to expose the fallacious nature of the cult of the dragon and to exalt the worship of the god of Daniel. Now, for most of you, you're thinking, what in the world is he talking about? Well, I thought it would be fun. It's short. I'm going to read you Bel and the Dragon, okay, chapter 1. There is, you know, in this is the Apocrypha, okay? So, you know, it's a book that you, essentially, I mean, what I'm going to do here is I'm just going to link it to, let's see, I'll read it from the Lexham English Septuagint. Let's go there because, again, this is part of the Old Testament Apocrypha. And part of the Apocrypha, again, this is going to be part of the Septuagint, these extra books. Part of it is a book called Bel and the Dragon, which is set in the time of Daniel, and it's sort of cast as a remainder, you know, stuff that didn't make it into the book of Daniel, but it's still about Daniel, all right? And so the first chapter has this little story about Daniel exposing the deceitful priests of Bel, Marduk. So here we go. You're gonna find out shortly why I bring this up, because there's also a dragon in the story that was being worshipped. Okay. From the prophecy of Habakkuk, the son of Joshua, from the tribe of Levi, a certain man was priest whose name was Daniel, the son of Aval, a confidant of the king of Babylon. Now there was an idol named Bel that the Babylonians worshipped. and there was lavished upon it each day the finest wheat flour, 12 artabas of flour, and 4 sheep, and 6 measures of olive oil. And the king revered it, and the king went forth each day and prostrated himself to it. But Daniel prayed to the Lord, and the king said to Daniel, "Why do you not worship Bel?" And Daniel replied to the king, "I worship no one except the Lord God, who created the heaven and the earth, and the one who holds power and authority over all flesh." And the king said to him, "This, therefore, is not a god? Well, you know, this statue is not a god. What do you mean? Do you not see how much is consumed for him every day? Like they bring all the food out, and then it's gone." Okay, and Daniel replied to him, "By no means let anyone deceive you, for this thing is on the inside mere clay, and on the outside it's bronze. I vow now to you by the Lord, the God of gods, that this thing has never eaten anything." Okay? And having become angry, the king summoned the attendants to the holy place and said to them, "Show plainly the one who is eating the things being prepared for Bel. And if not, indeed you will die. Or Daniel, who affirms that these things are not being consumed by him." And they said, "Bel himself is the one who's consuming these things." And Daniel said to the king, "Let it be just so. If I do not show that Bel is not the one who is consuming these things, I will die, and all those who are mine." Now there were attached to Bel 70 priests, besides women and children. So they brought the king into the idol's temple, and the food was set before the king and Baal, and mixed wine was brought in and set before Bel. And Daniel said, "See, you know, you yourself see that these things are laid out, O king. You therefore set a seal on the keys of the temple when it's closed up." And the arrangements were pleasing to the king. Now Daniel ordered those with him, after forcing everyone from the temple, to mark clearly the whole temple with ashes, with no one of those outside of it observing. In other words, they put like an ash powder around the temple, because, you know, if anybody walks in and gets in there, the gig's going to be up here. So then, sealing the temple, he ordered them to seal it up with the signet ring of the king, with the seal rings of some of the most notable ones of the priests. And so it was done, just in this manner. Then it happened on the next day, the king was present at the location, but the priests of Bel, by means of secret entrances, had entered in and eaten everything which was placed besides Bel, and they had quaffed down the wine. And Daniel said, "Look closely at your seals to see whether they're still in place, O men and priests. And you yourself, O king, take care, lest something suspicious is going on." Indeed, they found the seal was unchanged, and they removed the sealed lock. And when they had opened the doors, they saw that all the things had been set out that had been set out were consumed. The tables had nothing on them. The king was overjoyed and said to Daniel, "Great is Bel, and there's no deception with him." Then Daniel laughed out loud and said to the king, "Come here, see the deception of the priests. O king, these footprints, whose are they?" And the king replied, "Of men and of women, of children." And he went to the house in which the priests were living and found the food for Bel along with the wine. So, I mean, you know, they're caught. They get caught in the act. And right after the story, we have this. Daniel does something else. It says, "Now there was a dragon in the same location, and the Babylonians worshipped it. And the king said to Daniel, 'You will certainly not say concerning this that it's merely bronze. Indeed, he lives and eats and drinks. Worship him.' And Daniel said, 'O king, give me the power, and I will slay the dragon without sword or staff.' And the king granted him authority and replied to him, 'I give it to you.' And Daniel, taking 30 minas of pitch and hard fat and hair, boiled it together and made a lump from it and threw it into the mouth of the dragon. And after consuming it, the dragon burst open, got a bad case of indigestion, and he showed it to the king, saying, 'Do not worship such things, O king.'" Now, I like the story, because there's a real dragon in it, whatever that was, or, you know, it could be made up. But there you have a dragon associated with the worship of Babylon, the worship of Bel, okay? So some have, you know, take this and wonder, well, again, this is part of the Septuagint. You know, it's Mesopotamian, you know, it's Babylonish religion, you know, is this part of what's going on here? I don't really think so, other than, again, you know, we have this verse in Jeremiah about Bel, Marduk, the swallower of the nations, chaos imagery. And so what Noble does in his article is he brings this up and he says, you know, maybe this is part of a dragon tradition, a Tunnian tradition, you know, and he tries to connect this with the swallowing and so on, so forth. I don't really think so, because Bell and the Dragon as a text does not specifically connect the dragon with Bell. It just has, there's two episodes in the same chapter, and the Babylonians are worshiping both. So there's no specific connection, but I thought it would be fun. A lot of you have never heard of Bell and the Dragon as a story, and I know you're interested in such things. So if you get the article by Nogle, he's going to bring this up. You're going to wonder what it is. There it is. That's the story. The Babylonians, in fact, if you ask somebody who's an ancient Near Eastern scholar about this, they're going to point out that as far as we know from Babylonian material, they didn't really worship living snakes or serpents or large lizards. But you got this story in Bell and the Dragon, intertestamental text. There you go. Jewish text. Maybe they're just poking fun at Bell, and they're poking fun at Tiamat, the chaos imagery. Who knows? But there's this big argument over how seriously to take the story. So what we can say with confidence, again, I just threw that in at the end, what Nogle is trying to do is he's trying to ferret out certain elements of the Jonah story that describe Leviathan and Jonah in the same, or that describe, Leviathan and Sheol, that connect these two things. And he goes out to other passages and he's basically shown, we've gone through a little list of them, how if you look at the story of Jonah, in chapter 2 especially, the way this is told is not just, Jonah jumps in the water, he gets thrown in the water, and then he gets swallowed by a fish, and then he gets spit out. There's more to it, because Jonah himself, the writer puts in Jonah's mouth in his prayer the language of Sheol, and he describes the scene with certain verbs and nouns that are found elsewhere in association with Leviathan, with the cosmic dragon. So Nogle's saying, look, you have all the elements here, and they're just sort of floating around, pardon the pun, they're floating around in the chapter, especially chapter 2 in Jonah. And basically, this is his case. He says, essentially what you can say with confidence is this. The Jonah story of the great fish certainly includes imagery and vocabulary found in both descriptions of Leviathan and its home, the Chaos Sea, for sure. Secondly, Jonah and other Old Testament passages sometimes conflate the Chaos Sea imagery with Sheol, the realm of the dead. So those two thoughts are absolutely demonstrable, again, in the passage. And so what Nogle, the way he sort of draws this together is, look, if you have those two thoughts in your head and you're reading the story of Jonah, or you're the Septuagint translator, Leviathan, chaos, sea, chaos imagery, Sheol. Okay, the vocabulary that I'm looking at here as a translator comes from passages that evoke those three things. The Leviathan serpent, the chaos sea in which Leviathan lives, and the realm of the dead. So the argument is that the translator knew that. The translator understood it. And for that reason, when translating this passage in the Septuagint, he gets to the word dog, dog gadol, the great fish. And he says, I'm going to use katos, because that's really what's going on here. What Jonah is really about is he's being conquered by the forces of chaos, forces of evil, anti-Eden. He's being punished here. He's fallen victim to it. And you say, well, it feels like a bit of a disconnect because, God sends the fish and so on and so forth. Okay. What I'm not telling you, and again, you can get Nogle's article, is that there are places where the way Jonah himself is described, the same terminology is used of Jonah as the fish and the chaos terminology. It's actually applied to Jonah. And so, Nogle speculates on what the author is trying to do. That basically Jonah, by his disobedience to God, has become an agent of chaos. That's what Nogle thinks in the end. So he's being punished and swallowed up, really as a result of his own disobedience. God is using, or allowing, or, they're under his command anyway. I mean, Job 41, who commands Leviathan? It's God. to punish Jonah for his disobedience, for essentially volunteering to be an agent of chaos against God's wishes to go to the Ninevites and preach to them. So we've got a couple of reversal things going on here. And Jonah comes out in the end looking pretty bad. Like he's on the wrong side. And you know what? He is. He is on the wrong side. But who rescues him? Is God vengeful? Is God angry? Does God say, yeah, you got what you deserve? No, God is the one who pulls him out of the trouble. The same fish is commanded to vomit him out. God, to paraphrase Jeremiah 41, God extracts the thing that the dragon had swallowed. He extracts Jonah, pardons him, has mercy on him, and then sends him back to the Ninevites. And again, we know the rest of the story. But again, for our purposes, I think it's kind of neat that if, you know, by way of implication, if this is really what Jonah is about, you know, and again, the text does seem to suggest this, that it really is Leviathan imagery. It's really, you know, underworld imagery. That much is pretty obvious. Where you get underworld imagery, it's not a coincidence that you get these four or five things that pop out of Leviathan passages that wind up in Jonah 2. It does seem like the writer is trying to connect these things in the mind of the reader. And so this gets picked up on by the Septuagint translator and explains why he uses a word that he doesn't use. They don't use anywhere else to translate just dog, fish, except for here. So if all that's the case, then the analogy, you know, Jesus using the analogy is actually kind of cool. Who overcomes chaos and the realm of the dead? It's Jesus. You know, using the same story of Jonah, again, moves the analogy for the resurrection. It moves it well beyond just chronology or timekeeping. It's an ideal analogy for reversing and defeating chaos and death itself, especially if later readers in Jesus' day understood the connection between katos and drakon, in other passages, the dragon. They are both used to render leviathan, leviathan. It's easy to see how early Christians, Greek readers, they're the ones reading the Septuagint. Early Christians, they read Greek. It's easy to see how early Christians, Greek readers, would associate this story with victory over the devil, over the serpent, through the Septuagint translation. Okay. And while you're wondering, in Genesis 3, no. Serpent there, Nakash, is not rendered by Katos. It is Ophis, which is the normal word for snake. But since the serpent, in a wider sense, is part of the chaos tradition, all that is not what it's supposed to be, all the forces that are opposed and hostile to God's wishes, since the serpent is certainly part of the chaos tradition in the Bible, again, the conception still retains coherence, you know, theologically. So again, I thought this would be an interesting little sidebar episode. And for me, again, our point with the episode is not, you know, what's the nature of the Jonah story? Is it like a historical blow by blow, you know, kind of thing, you know, that we've got to, you know, read a certain way to make it history or to ensure it's history. Again, that's a separate question, as opposed to, is it, you know, symbolical or allegorical or parable? Again, it doesn't really matter. What I'm after here is for you to see that in the story, whether it's a historical, you know, record or whether it's a parable, the story itself is about the reversal of chaos and the defeat of the forces of chaos. Jonah is about that. You know, and Jonah is about what happens when people that God calls to do something align themselves opposite him. They become agents of chaos. You know, and again, God's mercy extracts us, you know, from that situation. But ultimately, it's really about, you know, the reversal, the defeat of these forces. And so for Jesus and the New Testament, you know, gospel writers to pick up on this and include it in their presentation of Jesus, I think is significant. It is the perfect analogy if you, again, have this sort of stuff floating around in your head.
All right, Mike, hopefully this episode will be a consolation prize for the voters who voted for Jonah. Hopefully, which you only have one more week to vote, so I don't think we're going to move the needle, but hey, stranger things have happened. So go to nakedbiblepodcast.com to vote. 1 week left, Halloween at Midnight is when it ends. And right now, Old Testament Revelations holding steady at 68%, 15%, 16% voted for Jonah. So hopefully for those folks, they got to at least whet their appetite on Jonah.
Yeah, there's a lot of strange stuff in Jonah. I mean, this is sort of a big one in there, but there's other stuff too.
Next week, Mike, we're going to be interviewing John Hilber.
Yep, John Hilber and his. We're going to talk. You know, he has a book on Old Testament cosmology and the whole idea of accommodation. You know, basically what his book is about is how do we think about the disconnect between the way an ancient person would have read the Bible, okay? And he uses cosmology to illustrate these things, but how, you know, the whole set of ideas, the matrix of ideas that's floating around in the head of an ancient Israelite, they're reading the text and thinking one set of things. How do we handle the fact that, well, that's kind of obvious, but we're not them. And so when we look at the text, we think of a whole different set of things. You know, how do we sort of think about that in terms of hermeneutical method, interpretive method? You know, how do we know when to sort of look at something literally, if they were looking at it literally or not, you know, vice versa. So we're going to talk a little bit about, you know, that the whole problem of, you know, using ancient Near Eastern comparative material and the fact that we aren't them. You know, how can we sort of do the right thing or do a better job of interpreting scripture when we have this gap between ourselves and the original writers?
We'll be looking forward to that. And with that, I want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.